From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Israel stepped up heavy military operations in the West Bank today. Israeli tanks and troops moved into three towns in an attempt to clamp down on Palestinians following a string of recent suicide bombings, including one today in West Jerusalem. Today's with the seventh terrorist attack in 6 days. There seems to be no end in sight to the escalating violence. The pattern has become all too familiar. Terrorist attacks bring military reprisals, which in turn spur more terrorist attacks. Tonight we're asking, can a military effectively fight terrorism? First, the word on the ground. Earlier, I spoke with Cameron Barr, the Christian Science Monitor reporter in Jerusalem. I asked for the latest on the Israeli push into the West Bank.
It's diversifying and spreading. The Israelis occupied the town of Qalqilya in the northern West Bank. They are massed around the town of Bethlehem today, and we expect that they will move into Bethlehem in a matter of hours. They're maintaining their positions in Ramallah around Yasser Arafat's compound. I talked to residents of Ramallah today who said there was a lot of activity around one of the refugee camps in Ramallah, tanks moving in, explosions heard, that kind of thing. It seems that the Israelis are pressing forward. The prime minister has said that the country is at war. There was a new reason to pursue that war tonight, a car bomb in Jerusalem. Apparently a suicide bomber was driving toward his destination, stopped by police at a checkpoint, and then detonated his charge, killing himself and injuring, I think, three people, including the policeman.
What exactly are the Israelis doing on the ground in the West Bank now, house to house or building to building? What is the very stuff of their activity? What are they actually doing?
Well, as you say, they're going house to house. They're rounding people up. The Israeli army said today that it had arrested 700 people in Ramallah. The Israelis have been moving through the streets using loudspeakers to demand that all men between the ages of 16 and 60 step out of their houses for screening. And many of those men are then sent away to destinations unknown. They're also moving into houses to search for weapons, to search for militants. I talked to a woman today who lives not far, two blocks away from Yasser Arafat's compound. The Israelis broke into her house. She said they were not offensive, was her term, but they did search the entire house thoroughly. They also seem to be, they've been running into some gunfights, too, in one building near the center of Ramallah. There was resistance, and I think 8 Israeli soldiers were wounded in a burst of fighting.
So then this Israeli operation is different in intensity and depth from those that have preceded it?
And scope. I think Israelis expect to see their soldiers in almost every part of the West Bank and even the Gaza Strip.
What is the goal exactly?
That's what people don't know. I mean, the goal of Israeli military action against the Palestinians until now has been to apply pressure on Yasser Arafat. The idea being that Yasser Arafat was ultimately responsible for the acts of terrorism that are performed against Israelis, and therefore he should be pressured to stop it. But at this point, Yasser Arafat has a hard time charging his cell phone, much less garnering the political support for any sort of move to protect Israeli security or the means. Most Palestinian police facilities have been demolished or they're now surrounded by Israeli forces, and no one can move in a place like Ramallah.
Cameron Barr, you've written that on both sides of this conflict, it's now a situation of all attack and no end game. What do you mean by that?
It's a no-way-out situation at this phase. The Palestinians are more determined than ever to pursue their tactics, including terrorism, including suicide bombings, to achieve what they call the end of occupation. I think the Palestinians have achieved singular political unity around this goal, and there's massive broad-based support for these acts of violence because they see the signs of success. They see that Israelis are this was more true a few days ago, a week ago, than it is now. But they see signs of division on the Israeli side, and they see that their goal, the idea of a Palestinian state, is gaining international currency. It's something that the UN has used in a Security Council resolution. President Bush has talked about it. The Arab states have coalesced to say that this is what they would like to see.
So that does sound like an end game, Cameron.
Well, that's an end game for the Palestinians. The Palestinians have always had a clear political goal in this conflict. But the Israelis haven't. And the Israelis are embarked on this huge police action, would be the probably an understatement, but it is at least a police action encompassing literally millions of people. And toward what end? It's a good question. And it's not clear what that end is.
The announced goal is to free Israel from the threat of terrorism, to crush the terrorist infrastructure.
It's hard to find Israelis who really believe that. We've had briefings here with, you know, senior security officials who have expressed doubts that any sort of satisfactory conclusion can be reached without a political component. And yet there is no political component on the table right now at all. There's only this military component that the Israelis are pursuing.
Cameron, what about the suicide bombings? Is there a system required, a kind of a bomber training factory and equipping factory required to send these bombers out? Is it assumed that there's some kind of central or dispersed organization that equips them with belts and explosives and the technique and the know-how to pull off these suicide bombings?
There's a certain amount of technology required, and it's not very sophisticated, but yes, someone has to make the bomb. I think it used to be that people who took this step did so on the basis of a lot of personal preparation. I mean, they call it prayer, and you're spending time in the mosque and that sort of thing in order to prepare themselves. Nowadays, we see more and more cases where people, almost on the spur of the moment, present themselves to an organization that can equip them with the material and can deliver them to some spot in Israel where they can do their deed, and then it happens relatively quickly. So I think it really varies. Some of them are the product of a lot of work, and others do it off the cuff.
And can you tell us very specifically, to the extent that you understand it, exactly what is Yasser Arafat's situation now? How near or far is he from Israeli forces surrounding him, and what does the future look like?
Well, my understanding is that Israeli forces are controlling most of his compound, and that they are very close to him. We've just heard some reports that large explosions were heard at the compound, and I don't know what that will portend.
But close to him, as in on the other side of the door?
Yes. Apparently, the Israelis are near enough to him so that he can hear Hebrew being spoken.
Could it be that Arafat would simply be kept sealed in this room for weeks, months?
They've said that they won't kill him, they won't expel him, they don't want to harm him. So, and they have said, to take the cabinet at its word, that they wish to isolate him. So that means, it seems to me, keeping him in a windowless room, which is where he is right now. And then what? No one knows.
Cameron Barr, can you picture Palestinian leaders being removed and enough troops being put in place that the Palestinian population would become docile, that they would give up, in effect?
Honestly, I can't see it. I met 2 days ago in a refugee camp in Bethlehem a 14-year-old girl who said that if she could, she would become a suicide bomber. And this, for her, is not an abstract notion. The best friend of her older sister is a suicide bomber, was a suicide bomber, attacked an Israeli supermarket on Friday. And her own grandmother was sitting in the room with us. And we asked her, you know, what do you think that one daughter says she wants to do this and another is the best friend of a young woman who just did this very thing? And the grandmother said, I would do it too.
Cameron Barr is a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor in Jerusalem. On September 11th, Americans sat stunned as terrorists attacked their country. But outside the United States, many people said, welcome to our world. The U.S. was swift in its response. Less than a month after the attacks, America had launched powerful military action, promising to wipe out terrorism globally. Now, 6 months later, it's not clear exactly how effective the fighting has been. Key members of Al-Qaeda remain at large. The U.S. is still under high security alert, and guerrilla factions have regrouped and vowed to continue their mission of terror. For all the military action, terrorist threats continue to loom. Across the globe, suicide bombings, guerrilla attacks, and civilian targets have changed the face of warfare. Can they be stopped? How effective is military action against these threats? Can an army, any army, ultimately stop terrorism? And if it can, what will it take to achieve success? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. talk. Joining us from Chicago is John Mearsheimer. He's professor of political science at the University of Chicago and co-director of the university's program on international security policy. Good evening and welcome, John Mearsheimer.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. And with us from Vermont Public Radio is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, John.
John Mearsheimer, help us wade into this. Americans are watching the drama playing out in Israel, I think, with some increasing horror that this may, in fact, be a kind of template, this tit-for-tat that goes on and on, where terrorists seem to arise organically out of a population opposed to Israel. Is this the model for what we're getting into globally? And on a day or in days when the Israeli military is headed in force to the West Bank to try and, as they say, root out the infrastructure of terrorism, what's your assessment of a military response to the terrorist threat? Is it the only way or is it no way?
Well, I think that there are important parallels between the way the Sharon government is conducting the war on the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip and the way the Bush administration is conducting the war against terrorism, and that is that they're both privileging military force over getting at and solving the root political causes of the conflict. Both the Bush administration and the Sharon administration feel very strongly that if you use massive military force against terrorists and against host states, that they will roll over and throw their hands up and the problem will effectively go away. I think that's a fundamentally misguided approach to dealing with the problem. There's no question that there are going to be instances where you want to use military force, but I think it makes much more sense to think about what the root causes of the problem are and then address those problems as best you can and put the military instrument in the back closet and only pull it out when it's absolutely necessary. Just to go to the subject of the West Bank, mm-hmm. It's quite clear watching the Israelis over the past year and a half that using massive military force against the Palestinians does not make the problem go away. Indeed, as Cameron Barr said in the setup piece, if anything, it makes the problem worse.
John Mearsheimer, you're a West Point graduate. You were an officer in the U.S. Air Force. You studied military strategy for a long time, and what you're describing here seems to be exactly the debate over Israel. Now you're saying the Bush administration is making it global in a way. The Sharon government says we cannot talk about root causes until this terror stops. President Bush said over the weekend, as long as there's one grain of terror, we can't really get beyond that, and so the militaries have been pulled up. You're saying go to root causes, but when people are dying in the tens and scores in Israel in recent days from terror attacks, how does a country step back and go to root causes? How do you put the military away when the blood is flowing?
Well, it's very difficult to do because the emotions run high. One can understand why the Israelis are outraged by what these suicide bombers are doing to their society. But on the other hand, if you want to stop this, what's necessary is to deal with the root causes, which are political in nature. And I think, by and large, that means addressing the whole question of a Palestinian state. And there, I think the $64,000 question is whether or not the Israeli government is willing to grant the Palestinians control of virtually all of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The Sharon government is not interested in doing that. In fact, Ariel Sharon and his allies on the right have gone to great lengths throughout the 1990s to undermine the Oslo peace process. They have no interest in granting the Palestinians a viable state. And as long as that's the case, you're not going to get any political settlement here, and the terror is going to continue.
But they've got a tremendous military advantage over the Palestinians, as the United States has a tremendous military advantage over Al-Qaeda, over the Taliban, over any of the targets that have been named by President Bush. Can't that carry the day?
Well, I think in both of these cases, the answer is no. There's no doubt that when you look at conventional and nuclear forces, both the United States and the Israelis have a tremendous advantage. But the problem is that those forces are just not very effective against terrorists, especially against suicide bombers. It's very hard to find them. It's very easy for the terrorists to make bombs and to bring them to the target. And given the tremendous resolve that members of Al-Qaeda and members of Hamas and other Palestinian groups have. It's just very hard to get at them.
John Mearsheimer, stand by. We're going to get into these details. Is military attack a winning strategy in the war on terrorism? Is there another way or no other way? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And tonight, as Israeli tanks and troops are active in the West Bank and American troops and military machinery are active around the world, we're examining the question of exactly how effective military power can be in responding to terrorism. Our guest is John Mearsheimer. He's professor of political science at the University of Chicago. He's a West Point grad, a former U.S. Air Force officer, author most recently of the book The Tragedy of Great Power Politics. John Mearsheimer makes the case that the military is not an effective instrument against terror. Obviously, many other people think otherwise. Jack Beatty, you can see this debate has shaped up over years in Israel and in some degree is now shaping up in the U.S. as well.
Yes, but as John said, it's a sort of hypothesis that's had now superabundant proof. We've tested it. They've tested it now over 18 months. They've increased the force level, and at each time, the cycle has turned against them with more bombers. So it's been proven not to work. What's really striking here to me is just how malignly incompetent these leaders, Arafat and Sharon, are. They thought they could lead their people to peace through war. Arafat, by condoning or at any rate allowing the and perhaps even perpetrating the Intifada, and Sharon now trying to solve a political problem, which people have said for generations is a political problem, through some final throw of the military dice. It's horrifying to think these talented, richly gifted peoples who've suffered so much, both of them, should be in the hands of people of this old men who have these bitter hatreds and who can't see beyond their hatred of one another. It's just awful.
We're talking tonight about terrorism and military power and how effective the latter can be in addressing the former. Is terrorism ultimately vulnerable to military power? Is it defeatable by military power? And if not, then what? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined now by Victor Davis Hanson. He's professor of classics at California State University in Fresno, a military historian. His most recent book is Carnage and Culture, Landmark Battles in the Rise of Western Power. Good evening and welcome, Victor Davis Hanson.
Good evening.
Victor Davis Hanson, from your visits to our show before, we know that you are a believer in the power of military well applied to deal with terror. Do you think that still holds true today with the kind of weapons and that terrorists are able to use against modern military powers?
Well, don't mischaracterize the argument. I think your former guests have somewhat that's all that people are trying to do. The Bush administration is giving multi-million dollars of aid to rebuild Afghanistan, mm-hmm, to ensure, mm-hmm, that these cells do not appeal to people. And we're doing that worldwide. It's not just a military solution. As far as the root causes, I'd like to just preface that. We don't know what the root causes are because in 1947, 1956, and 1967, when the West Bank was in Arab hands, three wars started to destroy Israel. And when Israel has not replied to 40 Scud missiles hitting it from an Arab country, mm-hmm, and when they unilaterally withdrew from Lebanon, and when they offered to give up 97% of the West Bank, there was not a reciprocal movement for peace on the part of their neighbors. Mr. Sharon is not a creation of the Israeli people as much as is a creation of the failed policies that Mr. Baruch gave, which was very generous, 97%, and he was willing to go further. And so the Israeli people did not want Mr. Sharon. They wanted him. Mr. Arafat delivered him on a platter to them because they saw what happened when they went unilaterally and gave almost everything that the Palestinians wanted. They got the Intifada for their purposes. As far as military, I think it's a little bit disingenuous to say that's all they're doing. They have tried to have some. There's a Tenet plan, there's a Mitchell plan that both sides have agreed to. Mm-hmm. But you have this problem where Mr. Arafat, on the one hand, sanctions and supports and subsidizes these terrorists, and on the other hand, says that he can't control them. And so, finally, there is a history that people, and we've got to remember one key factor that's being completely forgotten. It's not just does military power trump terrorism, it is military power of democracies. Okay. The United States is a democracy. Its enemies are not. And Israel is a democracy, and none of the 22 countries in its midst are. So when you have a democracy and these policies are being debated as they are right now in Israel, and the media is questioning, that's not a reciprocal, morally equivalent situation, because it's not happening in Al-Qaeda and it's not happening among the Palestinians. So there's a consensus. And when Mr. Sharon's efforts to stop terror do not work, if they don't work, then there's going to be a change of government. That's not true in Palestine. It's not true in Egypt. It's not true in Syria. And that means that military power has the support of a democratic people, and when it doesn't, it won't continue.
So you see military power, Victor Davis Hanson, not as gasoline on the flames, but rather as a significant part of a solution to terrorism.
It's a solution that's multifaceted, and the United States is doing a very good job right now of using military power in connection with appealing to women in Afghanistan, with supplying food, with supporting consensual government. And it's doing a great job in that sense. It's trying to do everything from giving prayer mats to people in Guantanamo Bay. It's waging a psychological war for the hearts and minds. And it's using military power. And it's a democracy. And if you look at the history of terrorists that do such things, whether it's the great Mahdi or Isama Cho in Japan or the kamikazes or the ghost dancers, that they have a very difficult time in disrupting democratic government.
John Mearsheimer, what do you make of this? Do you agree with Victor Davis Hanson that the United States and for that matter Israel are operating here with a balance of military and non-military effort? And do you think that balance is about right, as Victor Davis Hanson asserts?
Well, let's just talk a little bit about the Israeli case and the root causes of that conflict and how the Israelis have dealt with it. He said it's not clear what the root cause of the conflict is. I think it's perfectly clear what the root cause of the conflict is. It's the fact that the Israelis have occupied the West Bank and the Gaza Strip for 35 years, and they've basically treated the Palestinians like subhumans. They've violated their human rights and civil rights at every turn. Why do you think that huge numbers of Palestinians are willing to sacrifice their lives as suicide bombers? Why do you think
the same reason they were willing to do the same thing in 1947, 56, and 40, and 67? This idea that suddenly the West Bank is the issue has not been the issue. Maybe the last few decades.
So Victor Davis Hanson, you're saying it's all about Palestinian refusal to accept Israel.
Not all Palestinians. There's a large minority of Palestinian fanatics that are not, either won't be or cannot be controlled by the central government. And they see this, if you read their own literature,
and
as
that does
phase
not
one.
Include That does not include Yasser Arafat. You want to remember?
It does not include Yasser. Who do you think that these terrorist bombers have been doing, and what do you think his past career has been doing?
John Mearsheimer,
before the 67 war.
One can support terrorism and still accept the existence of Israel, as Arafat does.
One can support. Why do you think he supports the existence of Israel? He's never done it in the past.
He has. He's made it very clear.
He had a wonderful Camp David proposal from Clinton. He shut it off.
Excuse me, but Ehud Barak was perfectly willing to go to Camp David with him and negotiate a solution to the Arab-Israeli conflict. And even after Camp David failed and the Intifada started, Barak was still willing to negotiate with him.
He was. That's a very good point.
As you pointed out, Barak was willing to concede a large portion of the West Bank to Arafat.
That's right.
John Mearsheimer, I want to break in here. John, if you would, and Victor Davis Hanson, excuse me, if we could just kick this up now a notch. John Mearsheimer, how about the balance on the U.S. response to terrorism between the military element and the non-military elements? Do you think that the Bush administration has the formula about right?
No, I think that the Bush administration has privileged military force over diplomacy, and I think it's going to come back to haunt us over the long term. Just the fact that we have supported the Sharon government and its repressive policies on the West Bank and the Gaza Strip is going to cause us all sorts of problems in the long term, because people in the Arab and Islamic world are furious at us for our unalloyed support of
Sharon. But Victor Davis Hanson says that historically democracies can apply their military against, for example, kamikaze pilots in Japan and win.
Well, maybe he should think about the Vietnam War, where we fought from 1965 to 1972. And if my memory serves me correct, we left with our tail between our legs.
Well, that's because at a certain point, the United States decided that it wasn't in their interest for blood and treasure to win that war. But militarily, that war was winnable. But that's a decision that the United States people made, just as they will in the war against terror. But if you were asking from a strictly military point of view, what we have done, and remember that after September 11th, For 3.5 weeks, we heard that the Afghan winter was going to stop us. We heard that the Russians couldn't do it. We heard the British couldn't do it. We heard that they'd been fighting for 25 years. In less than 6 weeks, the most repressive medieval government in the Middle East was routed.
Jack Beattie, I want to bring you in here. What do you hear in this debate, Jack? You can see camps emerging in this issue of what's the way to attack terrorism and is the military the way?
Yeah, I just think the Bush administration is allowing the Sharon government to frame this in these stark terms. And in a way, of course, we have legitimated the principle that that government is following now. To terror, you respond with overwhelming military force. And so the president has rightly felt constrained about invoking principles to criticize Israel that we don't honor ourselves. So we're in a very strange situation here, and this whole notion of asymmetrical warfare really comes into play. We saw it on September 11th. The Israelis see it daily. And it seems to me that the infrastructure of terrorism really it has to do with people's thoughts. Has to do with hatred, has to do with grievances. And until you deal with that, an Israeli general was quoted the other day saying the supply of terror bombers is limitless. Well, if it's limitless, what is the alternative? A sort of genocidal policy? No. War is about politics, as John, who's written a book about Clausewitz, knows, by other means. What are the politics of the war on terrorism? It's not clear to me.
How did we win the United States? Could I ask how we won
Victor
the hearts and minds of the Japanese? How do we win the hearts and minds of the Japanese so that a nation of 90 million people that clapped when Nanking on the news of Nanking? How was it in 1946 women had the right to vote?
But can we nuke the West Bank?
How did we win the hearts and minds of Germany?
We destroyed their armies in the field. This is not a comparable situation.
Why isn't it?
That's exactly the question, Victor Davis Hanson. Here we had civilian airliners that plowed into the World Trade Center, not the Luftwaffe. Yeah. Isn't that a different situation?
We haven't had attacks since then. We're doing pretty good. I don't see airliners falling from the sky. I do see the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda running undercover. I've seen them take enormous losses and through conventional... I mean, we have special operations, but when they pilot a GPS laser into a cave, that's a conventional battle group that gives them that ability.
And yet the security alert is still high in the United States. I want to take a break to talk to our callers who want to come in here. We're talking about the effectiveness of military action together with the other accoutrements of the response. But at the core, a military action against terrorism. Does it work? What do you think? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Mark is on the line. Welcome, Mark. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I heard Mr. Hanson. I'd like to briefly say that his facts are very distorted, just like most of the media here, unfortunately, saying that what's going on, what was offered to the Palestinians by Barak was a generous offer, quote unquote. And everybody in the media tells that. But in fact, they were given little bastuntas, like South Africa, little encampments where they can live amongst luxurious settlements, Jewish settlements. And that was not acceptable. No Palestinian would accept it. That's all we have for.
Mark, we got it. Thank you for your call. Let me put that to Victor Davis Hanson. You can hear there, Victor Davis Hanson. Mark is representing the view that it wasn't a generous offer, that it wasn't satisfactory. I guess that is part of what continues to motivate Palestinians. Can they be stopped by tanks?
If you look at the history of war, offering back the 97% of the West Bank after that, there had been three previous wars, not to fight Israel, but to destroy Israel from the West Bank, in addition to Syria and Lebanon and Jordan and Egypt. That was much more generous than what we're giving the Germans today, because the Germans warred against their neighbors twice in the 20th century, and they lost almost 25% of their territory. And we do not see 9 million Germans suicide bombing Poles and French because they lost territory through war. I mean, we don't see people today in Tibet who are blowing up Chinese. We don't see people in Chechnya anymore.
Because they were utterly defeated. You're saying buck up and crush this resistance.
I'm not saying buck up and crush. That's a mischaracterization of what I said. I'm saying that continue with the diplomatic efforts, which we see with the Mitchell and Tenet plan, which we are, and then continue to strike back at these areas, and let's hope that we have some change in the situation. But I think we have to realize that these suicide bombers don't choose to go roll themselves under tanks. They could blow up a tank with that much explosives because they'd rather kill women and children. And unless we stop looking at this moral equivalence that we cloak as morality, when in fact it's abject amorality, because it's not the same.
Well, and that's what terror is all about. Matt is on the line. Welcome, Matt. You're on the air.
Thank you, gentlemen. I'd like to ask, was this perhaps Al-Qaeda's and Bin Laden's strategic aim rather than the tactical?
What in particular, Matt?
That we view the entire Middle East situation as terrorism versus states, et cetera, et cetera.
And draw the United States into that conflict?
Exactly.
John Mearsheimer, how about that?
Yeah, I think there's a little question that what Al-Qaeda would have liked to have done was got the United States to use massive military force in the Arab and Islamic world and create what Samuel Huntington has famously called a clash of civilizations.
Are we on that track now?
Well, I think we run the danger of being perceived by people in the Arab and Islamic world as waging war against them. And the more military force we use and the more we support the Sharon government and its policies on the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip, the more likely it is that people will be radicalized in the Arab and Islamic world and not only support terrorist activities, but join the terrorist activity themselves.
But what about the other argument that if terrorists, suicide bombers, are seen to have achieved results, we'll just see more suicide bombing?
That's a real danger. This is the problem that the Israelis face today. It's quite clear that Israel, at some point down the road, is going to have to agree to a Palestinian state if it has any hopes of shutting this problem down. But once they do that, then they, in effect, have caved into terrorism. And the Palestinians might very well then conclude that they can push further. The Israelis and the Americans are going to have to go to great lengths to prevent that from happening. But it's going to be a very tricky situation.
Victor Davis Hanson, you hear in the caller Matt's question the concern that we may be playing into Osama bin Laden's hands.
Well, we can play, but I don't think we should, to paraphrase Grant, I don't think we should keep worrying about what the enemy thinks of us or what they're going to do to us. And we better worry about what we're going to do to them. And we've heard these same arguments during the Iraqi situation, 50,000 dead Americans in the desert, and then we stop from going to Baghdad. You've got to remember, this issue is about the West Bank, and most Americans do support a Palestinian state. That's not the issue right now. The issue, because the governments in Israel have agreed to that in principle. They
but Ariel Sharon does not agree to a Palestinian state, and we're supporting Ariel Sharon.
He's agreed to the Mitchell and Tenet plans. He said, the President of the United States said that this morning. He's willing to go to Washington and discuss that. We also have to remember that
He has spent the entire 1990s trying to undermine the Oslo peace process. He may have, but he's said that today. Because of terrorism, and that's why the Israelis...
No, he's said that all along. If this issue is about occupation, per se, then there'd be a war right now in Lebanon because Syria occupies most of Lebanon.
Well,
if it's a war about the treatment of the Palestinians, then there'd be a war against Kuwait because they ethnically cleansed one-third of a million of them.
And yet, Victor Davis Hanson, we hear, in fact, that there's concern about Syrian troops getting involved at this moment. We're talking this hour about military action and terrorism. Is terrorism ultimately vulnerable to military power? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the effectiveness of military action against terrorism tonight. Our guests are John Mearsheimer. He's professor of political science at the University of Chicago and co-director of the university's program on international security policy. And military historian Victor Davis Hanson. He's professor at California State University, Fresno, and author most recently of Carnage and Culture, Landmark Battles in the Rise of Western Power. John Mearsheimer, I know we don't have you for much longer. We can all see the kind of tension that's building up over exactly this question, whether we've got the right balance. You say that the U.S. and perhaps Israel both have too much military in the mix. Look at U.S. policy with us for a moment. What would the right balance of military and non-military response to terrorism look like in your view?
Well, I would not be intervening with military forces in places like the Philippines and Georgia and assorted other places around the globe. I'd go to great lengths to keep my eye on Al-Qaeda. and not get involved in other guerrilla conflicts. Furthermore, with regard to the war in Afghanistan, I'd go to great lengths for the foreseeable future not to use heavy doses of air power in that area and not to commit too many ground forces and get involved in a counterinsurgency war. It appears now that that's what's happening. But just generally speaking, I'd go to considerable lengths to win hearts and minds in the Arab and Islamic world by changing American policies that people in that region find offensive and are not vital for American national security, and going to great lengths to target those terrorists who have us in their crosshairs.
Do you see anyone in the U.S. government, in the U.S. military, who's promoting this view?
Well, I think that the American military is quite reluctant to get involved in fighting the war on terrorism. I think, for example, with regard to Iraq, which I think attacking with military force would be a bad idea, I think the American military will be a main break on that. Certainly the American people tend to be in favor of using military force against Iraq, but I think the American military will be very reluctant to do that. And I think that's all for the good, because, again, I think using heavy military force against Iraq is likely to make our problem in the Arab and Islamic world worse, not better. And that is the root cause of terrorism against the United States as it manifested itself last September 11th.
John Mearsheimer, thanks so much for joining us this evening.
You're welcome, Tom.
John Mearsheimer is co-director of the University of Chicago's Program on International Security Policy. Jack Beatty, there you hear a guy who grew up in West Point and was a Air Force officer saying this is the wrong road to go down. On the other hand, Victor Davis Hanson says, look at history, and it is the application of overwhelming force when necessary, I hope I'm interpreting this correctly, that brings victory.
Well, brings victory when there are armies in the field. I mean, he instanced the Japanese and the Germans. Those were armies in the field. We destroyed the entire armies of the and navies of the opposition. These are asymmetric threats we're dealing with now. They're not armies and navies. They're clutches of terrorists who will stop at nothing. And the question and the problem, as John just outlined, is that this supply of terrorists can be built up by the very things we do against them. It's terribly unfair that war should be this way, that these great instruments we have should be really of very little value against this threat. But there it is. And to say, well, the past shows us this. Well, the past doesn't show us much like what the Israelis are facing today, having to live intimately with people who want their own land and who will stop at nothing to get it. And the past doesn't do much to help us, where we're fighting this network of faceless people around the globe who could strike us at any time. So I think, you know, Lincoln said it, as our cause is new, so we must think anew to act anew. And I have yet to see that from the Bush government.
Victor Davis Hanson, what about it? Are we moving beyond the lessons of history to some extent here?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that history ever changes that radically. The same principles are time immortal. We had Jewish terrorists fighting the Romans, the Sicarii. They popped up out of the street and slit a Roman's throat, and they all ended up at Masada. And as far as the Japanese example is exactly apt. By 1945, in April and May of 1945, the Japanese military didn't exist. We had 365 ships off of Okinawa. And there was 5,000 kamikazes. That was all they essentially had as far as naval and air power. Very asymmetrical. And they promised to do much more to us.
And how do we keep terrorists from coming through our borders, from coming into Manhattan, into Tel Aviv?
I'm kind of disappointed because I hear this hysteria, and it's out of a historical context. Just keep in mind, 6 months ago, at a time of peace, in a lax security, we had 3,000 people vaporized in Manhattan.
We don't think of remembering that as hysteria, and the Bush administration itself warns. Well, that we hear frequently from John Ashcroft and from the Bush administration. Be careful; the threat continues to be large and real.
But I'm saying our present conversation doesn't keep things in perspective. Hmm. Within 6 months, we went 6,000 miles across the globe and defeated the most terrifying government in that area, and in an area that we had been told. I was on your show in the fall, if you remember.
Very well.
And I was told again and again by your guests that we could not defeat the Afghan winter. We could not defeat the warlords. We could not defeat where Russia had failed.
But today, it's the Bush administration itself that continues to warn the country that this will be a long fight and that the threat remains real within the U.S.
But it's exactly right, and that's what we are. But we have to remember how far we've come. There hasn't been another major attack. We've replaced the government, the Taliban. There's a consensual government, it looks like, could take place. We are fighting al-Qaeda in the Philippines and Georgia, and the people are welcoming us in there to do it. And the military does not want to get bagged on. It's been very sophisticated. We're doing very well, and we have to ask ourselves, the Middle East has changed. You don't see, a la 1947, 56, 67, 73, that Syria, Egypt, Jordan would join in. They always used to, but they know that they can't do it anymore.
They can't because they respect or fear power, military power?
Exactly. That war would last 24 hours. You haven't seen Scuds attack as we did before. And we have this terrorism, but there was terrorism before the 67 war. There were suicide bombers. Nasser was gassing people in Yemen, just like Saddam Hussein did.
But the families who lost so many on the first night of Passover in Netanya and so many other locations in Israel, even with the Israeli military presence in the West Bank, the threat continues to come.
It's always going to be.
At what point can that be? Can we say goodbye to that?
The Israelis have lost a fraction of the people they lost in 1973 in the Yom Kippur War. Just a fraction of that. Keep that in mind. A fraction even of the 67 war.
Does that suggest we have to just come to terms with a certain amount of attrition of civilians to terror?
It means as long as there's human nature being what it is, and people are rational, not rational, and they don't fight, as we've been told this afternoon, or this evening, out of quote-unquote historical grievances, but they fight for things like honor and self-interest and fear, as the Thucydides, the historian, reminds us. That is what the problem is. There's envy, there's anger, but it's not always the fault of any one party. If you put a country like Israel that's secular, democratic, and free right next to its neighbors who are not, and there's not one democracy there, and it's prospering, it's a constant reminder of the failings of Arabic and Middle Eastern society. And in those closed societies, one of the ways that is vented by the governments is to allow them freedom to hate Israel and the United States.
Victor Davis Hanson.
The only way they can be taught that is to lose.
I'm afraid we're out of time, but we want to thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Victor Davis Hanson, thanks for being with us, is professor of classics at California State University in Fresno. His most recent book is Carnage in Culture, Landmark Battles in the Rise of Western Power. For the latest news on the conflict in the Middle East, go to our website at onpointradio.org. Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Up next, back to school in Kabul. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. There are a few places where children are excited about going back to school. But this week in Afghanistan, boys and girls couldn't wait to get back to class. Eric James is country director for Relief International, an organization that provides development assistance to victims of civil conflicts. He spoke with us by satellite phone from Kabul, where he is rebuilding the Mir Ahmad Shahid School. School started on March 23rd, and in this radio diary, Eric says rebuilding the education system in this war-ravaged country isn't easy, but Afghan children are thrilled to hit the books.
Before we started our project there, that part of Kabul was very heavily destroyed in the Civil War in 92. And so there was nothing but walls where buildings once stood, missing ceilings, no windows, doors, no parts of what you would normally consider a school. So we actually constructed 6 new classrooms and 2 separate buildings we rehabilitated. Part of the school is yet to be done, and that has to be done in a later phase. But if you look at the other parts of the neighborhood, you can see what a dramatic change there's been. Around the school, many buildings have been destroyed. So there's a lack of water, there's a lack of sanitation. There are a few freestanding buildings, but even those buildings have their windows blown out, and so there's plastic over the windows. It's a very dirty place. It's dusty. Everything's sort of brown, but you can see things sort of coming back to life with the school, with other projects that are going on in the area. first you start with actual construction or rebuilding the walls and that sort of thing, so that there's plastering involved, there's new roof timbers, new metal sheets for the roof. Then once the structure is sound, then you can start painting windows, doors. We've also fixed the latrines at the Mir Majid Shahid School, as well as put in a new well so that children can have water. Well, I've been very happy to be here, despite the difficulties of the work environment. And it's been very rewarding to see the dramatic change in just a short time. I should say that we're really only about not even halfway there. My NGO, Relief International, has rehabilitated over 200 classrooms so far, but our goal this year is 2,002 classrooms. So when their children are inside the classroom, they sit in rows like they do in an American school, and on the wall there's a blackboard, and the teacher, who usually doesn't have a desk, stands there and instructs like they would anywhere else. The benches sit two children apiece, but very often because of overcrowding, there will be many children there. So up to 60 to 80 children per classroom attend in two shifts. So at the Mir Ahmed Shahid School, where there's only 13 classrooms, there's about 1,000 students that attend this school. So it's very, very crowded. For the first time in many years, they're learning a sort of well-balanced curriculum. So it includes math, science, Dari, which is the local language, or Pashto. Some of the students do learn English, just the basic, what they call Afghan basic curriculum, ABC. Again, this is a big change from before, where the children were not taught these other things, and there was a very heavy emphasis on learning the Quran by rote. So when children went to school, they might have learned how to memorize the Quran, but they didn't learn how to read the Quran, so they couldn't read other things. They couldn't use mathematics in any sort of practical way. They didn't know anything about science. And now, with the introduction of the new curriculum, with new schools, new supplies, and so forth, they're getting a well-rounded education. School started on March 23rd. That's the day after New Year here in Afghanistan. And I can tell you that the children are very excited to be back at school. For many of them, they're going to school for the very first time. I just know that the students going back are very excited, and you can see them going to school with their bags. They are ready to learn. In many places, they've been given new schools. They want to participate in all the school activities that they can in terms of after-school activities that haven't even been set up yet, but that's something that they definitely want to do. Children here for the first time, and in 5 years, have been flying kites, have been listening to music, they've been playing soccer, all these things that were banned by the Taliban. You can see them on the streets doing. Every block has two or three kites flying from it. And that's something new in their lives. And they just want to be children, and this gives them a chance to.
Eric Jones works for Relief International. He spoke to us from Kabul, Afghanistan. Listeners, we'd like to hear from you. Are events in the news affecting you in a personal way? If you have a story that would make a good radio diary, email us. The address is onpoint@wbur.org. You can read or listen to other radio diaries on our website. Log on to onpointradio.org. Tonight, we'd like to send out a special welcome to On Point listeners at KSFC in Spokane, Washington. Welcome. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point from WBUR, Boston.
This is WBUR, where fun.